Thank you very much, Bob. And I'm glad that Illinois is winning, Mr. Kessler.
That's right.
Because this is Let's Get Legal powered by the Illinois State Bar Association. We have not one, but two University of Illinois professors coming on. And both said they would not come on unless Illinois won their game. So we would have had some big holes in the schedule to fill. But luckily, it looks like Illinois is well ahead. Yeah. Thanks for that.
Glad we could make it happen. Yeah. I mean, we still have another quarter.
You know, yeah. And as a U of I graduate myself, I've seen Illinois lose games with a bigger leads in the past. I think a lot of Illinois fans probably have. So fingers crossed that we can complete the show that way. Hey, I do want to start the show, and I have a couple themes running through today, including the craziest lawsuits you've ever heard of. And this one, I want someone to call in and see if they can guess the answer. I'll give you the tease. We'll get to be the answer at the top of the show here in a few minutes. 312-981-7200. If you can guess the answer to this, a 69-year-old Dutchman wanted to legally change what about himself. He felt he was discriminated at work because of this, and he felt like he was discriminated on Tinder. So he sued to get what changed. 312-981-7200. Let's see if we can start the show with a winner. Let's Get Legal powered by the Illinois State Bar Association after this on WGN. I'm John Hansen, and this is Let's Get Legal powered by the Illinois State Bar Association. Thanks so much for joining us here on this steamy Saturday afternoon in Chicago. We got a real great show for you today. You heard Ernie mention that we've got Kevin Camden coming on in just a little bit. We're going to talk wills. We're going to talk trusts, what you need, what maybe you don't need, and how they're able to help you out. We teased off the top that there's I'm going to do some crazy lawsuits throughout the show today. Some of them are crazy. Some the plaintiff wins. Some the plaintiff loses. They're tossed out immediately. But this one comes from the Netherlands. A 69-year-old Dutchman wanted to legally change what because he felt like he was discriminated against at work and on Tinder. Let's go to Shelley. Shelley, good afternoon. You're calling us from Elgin. And what's your guess here, Shelley?
Oh, he wanted his birth certificate changed. I think he wanted to shave 10 years off. It might have been 20.
His age. Yes, Shelley, you are correct. Had you heard of this story before?
I did indeed. Yeah. I didn't get the outcome.
Yes.
I didn't roll up to see what the end answer was.
Well, I do have
problems with the concept.
Yes. I imagine we would all love to shave 10 to 20 years off, depending on how old you may be. He claimed, his name was Emil Rattelband, he claimed that he was discriminated against at work and he was using Tinder, and it was hurting his success on the dating app. The judge ended up ruling that he could not change his age because, and it makes sense, so many rights and obligations, they're age-based, right? You can't just change your age, and legally changing your age could cause a lot of complications. So Shelley from Elgin, you got that one right. Thanks for calling.
Yay, thank you.
We appreciate that. Anthony was calling in too. A few others as well. We appreciate those. We'll have more as the show goes on. And at the end of the show today, our last game. Last week we did clips from law movies. We're going to do sound clips from law TV shows. The theme, we're going to give you a few seconds of the theme, and you're going to have to call in and guess what the show we're talking about is. And that's coming up a little bit later, but we appreciate all the participation. 312-981-7200 is the phone number here. In just a little bit, I mentioned to Mr. Kessler that we've got two University of Illinois professors coming. And after the break, we're going to talk to Dr. Brian Andres about something that hefty garbage bags, vanilla, and sparkling water all have in common. All three of those things have something in common. It has to do with law, and we're going to explain after this on Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association. Hey, everyone. John Hansen here. Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association. You're listening to WGN. We are got a beautiful view on a gorgeous Saturday, a little hot and steamy outside. And we're joined now, and I kind of teed this up beforehand about what hefty garbage bags, vanilla, and sparkling water have in common. We're going to get an answer here from Dr. Brian Andres, U of I professor and director of Bach Ag Law Policy Program. Dr. Andres, I'm glad Illinois is winning their football game that we have you on the line here, sir.
Yeah, John, it's great to be here, and I have to admit, I did check the score a few minutes before popping on the phone here with you. So, okay. Yeah, it's a good Saturday afternoon here in Urbana.
Yeah, fingers crossed. As a U of I graduate myself, I've got one eye on the score as well. But for now, let's talk about what those three things and many other things have in common. They have to do with false advertising for food and beverage cases, which... Reading one article says that even during this COVID-19 pandemic, we've seen more cases in the past year than any other year prior. Do you have any idea why that is? Can you set this up a little bit for us?
Yeah, I'll try to set it up a little bit. And you know, I've been teaching food law for quite a while, and I was always talking to students about, you know, what are the current things in food law? And about 10 years ago, we started talking about all of these labeling claims that were happening where it wasn't the federal government, the FDA, enforcing labeling rules. It was private parties suing under state consumer fraud or deceptive business practices acts. And in the last 10 years, I've just really seen this momentum that seems to be a snowball of just different claims being made against these food packaging. It's pretty fascinating.
Yeah, and as we back up just a little bit, the rules and regulations that are set up by the FDA require obviously certain things to be. I mean, we see the food labels all the time about, you know, certain fat, calorie content, sodium, and the ingredients in them. The lawsuits over the last few years, are they about those labels, or are they about more of the front side of the label of what the product is trying to advertise about itself and what it claims to be?
Yeah, absolutely. It's all about the front of the package, what the consumer sees in that grocery store aisle, and different companies trying to set their product apart. I mean, it's a highly competitive industry. And so what I'm seeing from my perspective is sometimes companies are pushing it a little bit too far and making claims that, you know, may be a little bit deceptive to the average consumer. And the on the back of the label, everything's 100% accurate. The ingredients are disclosed precisely, all that nutrition information. That's not the problem. It's that you could almost look at it that advertising side, the front of the label of the package.
Is it because we are more socially conscious about where food comes from, and food products, knowing that, are trying to make that an attractive part of the product, and there is where we get some gray area about what they're saying, is if it truly does advocate for what they are trying to say they're advocating for?
Oh, for sure. I mean, just think about the claim natural. Mm-hmm. What does that mean anymore? And some studies show that less than half of consumers even trust that label.
Are there rules about, I hate to interrupt you, but so when you say the word natural, I see that all over the place, right? So who regulates, is that the FDA that regulates what that word means, or how do we get, you know, firm rules on this?
Well, there's two different regulatory agencies, depending on whether you're talking about meat versus other food products. And if it's meat, it's USDA, and there are a little bit more defined rules, to use the term natural. But in other food products, you can sort of say it's minimally processed. And what does that mean? I mean, there's just such ambiguity in there that companies will, try to push that a little bit, and then you'll have some creative plaintiff's attorneys pushing back and saying, that's just deceptive. So I think part of it is consumers want to understand that food is not just calories into the body, but there's all these other attributes, whether it's organic or natural, healthy, added sugars. And so all these different attributes that companies use to try to set their product apart also entails some risk that maybe it's a little bit deceptive.
Is part of the problem that it seems like every 6 months there's a new buzzword to describe something that people want, and it's almost impossible to have a regulatory body monitor, change, rewrite every 3 or 4 months when there's a new buzzword, and it's really up to the courts, the consumers, and the marketplace is a way to kind of decide what is and isn't okay.
Yeah, I mean, things move fast, and I think that's part of it. The federal government You know, also we talk about FDA, but there's also FTC, Federal Trade Commission, that could look at these sort of situations. But things are moving so fast that my view is that the government's sort of stepping aside and focusing on some of the big issues, and letting some of this these things we're talking about play out just between consumers directly with the businesses, and the government's sort of on the sidelines.
I just want to clarify what that means. I want to clarify what that means. So what you're saying is that if you final file a complaint against a company, you just go through the litigation process through the courts, and it's decided that way, as opposed to a complaint to a federal body that then they come back with rulings and fines and you know, punishments for companies that disobey the rules.
Yes, thank you for that clarification. You stated it precisely.
That's very rare on this show. I usually ask the dumb question and have a real dumb guess. So I'm really happy I got one there. Let's talk about a few specifics, because I was going through some of the examples, listening to this, reading this article on fooddive.com. I mean, it's not only natural products, but it's things that we have to do about, you know, keeping a green environment. I mean, Hefty garbage bags saying that they're recycling bags, even though there's a lawsuit saying that they're not recyclable and they're indistinguishable from regular bags. I guess talking about that example and others, is it up to the consumer just to kind of do their homework at this point?
Well, I think so. It's up to the consumer to do their homework for sure. But but what you mentioned is this idea of greenwashing.
Mm.
And it's across so many consumer products. And I think my expertise is in the food side of greenwashing, so to say, as opposed to the Hefty recyclable garbage bags or any of those things. But, you know, it could even be on clothing or other products. And it is up to the consumer. And but then again, it's awfully expensive for a consumer to go and try to file a lawsuit against a company or push back on it. And that's where I think social media can play a role in, you know, putting some pressure on companies to scale back some of these claims.
Yeah, and then that's what I was going to ask too, because, like, let's say I bought something that said it had vanilla in it or was vanilla flavored and it doesn't quite live up to what I thought it was. Why am I going to be the one, like, what do I do? Like, why am I going to hire a lawyer? What's the harm that's really been done to me? Is it really worth it? So is it about, you know, teaming up, class action lawsuits, or, like you say, not even going through the courts? It's about putting it out there on social media and hoping that you can pressure a company that way.
Yeah, I think it's a two-pronged strategy. Social media, of course. And then all these cases that we're hearing about are class action lawsuits, because the harm to an individual consumer might just be the difference in price they would have paid for something had it had actual vanilla in it versus not. Or my favorite is the ginger ale that made with real ginger, but you couldn't detect ginger in the actual product. And so, right, what is the damage of a few cents
right to
the individual consumer? But it adds up when you multiply that across the nationwide market.
So who organizes these class action lawsuits? I always see commercials for them or hear them and say, oh, well, that might affect me. Is it private companies that literally seek out and try and find the class action lawsuits so that they can, well, advocate for people but also make a little money too?
Yeah, I think you're exactly right on that too. So you're two for two today. So you have a few firms that are specializing in this. And basically it's those firms that were doing class action lawsuits before and then realized nobody's been looking at the food market for years. And it really wasn't until about 2008 in a case out of California was sort of the first one. It was like, wait, you know, there's potential money to be made here from, you know, the plaintiff's lawyer side, but there's also real, I think, injustice on the consumer side. That's how it happens.
Yeah. The FDA and the FTC, right, they're supposed to be these independent bodies, regardless of the administration that is in charge. At least, correct me if I'm wrong, but does it matter which party is in power or which party is in the White House? Do you see different changes depending on whether it's a Democrat in the Oval Office or a Republican in terms of how aggressive these agencies are, or are they fairly independent in how they operate?
Fortunately, in my experience, I have not seen a real shift between administrations. And I think part of it is you kind of asked it earlier, is, well, what's the real harm to the consumer? And it's more of a financial harm. And where I see the agencies concentrating are on things where there are real serious health effects, like allergens, for example. If someone is mislabeling allergens, you know, their people's lives are at risk. And so I tend to see that's where the government is focusing its effort. Now, having said that, in the last administration, there was a lot of pushback on plant-based milk or cell-based meat. How should that be regulated and labeled? And or things like added sugar. But I will say that the current Biden administration is sort of following through with this sort of regulatory rethink on what the federal government's position should be. But again, that's independent as far as what's going on in the private litigation, class action litigation.
Yeah, you bring up such a great point earlier, too, about this idea of, well, how much does a company risk misleading people, right? Like, it might get you to buy a couple things off the shelf, but then you risk a big social media outcry or something. I got to share this. I took a picture of it a couple weeks ago when I was at the Jewels. I won't mention the brand, but I did appreciate this honesty on a package of cheese. It was labeled as a smoked, pasteurized, processed Gouda cheese product. And that did not sound appetizing, but I tell you what, I'm glad they didn't try and sell me a bill of goods there, doctor.
Well, I'm glad that you did it. And, you know, over the years, I've had current and former students send me photos all the time of, I just found this product in the grocery store. I thought you'd like to see it. So send that my way if you don't
mind. I will.
I'd love to throw that up on a sliding glass.
Nothing sounds yummier than a smoked, pasteurized, processed Gouda cheese product. All right, Dr. Brian Enders, thank you so much for joining us. And I know Mr. Kessler will give us an update, but the Illini appear to still be ahead 30-16. So ILL, my friend.
Great. ILL.
All right, take care.
Bye.
All right, we got plenty more coming up here on Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association. I'm John Hanson. This is Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association. I've been doing a little thread here of the craziest lawsuits you've ever heard of. Not to put you on the spot, Mr. Camden, but you want to play our game here today?
We're having a guess. We'll take a guess.
Yeah, we'll take a guess. All right. This one goes back a couple years. You may have heard about it. 2017. We've all had dates gone wrong in our... Well, not you, Kevin. I know every day you've ever been on long ago was successful, of course. A true gentleman you are. But this guy, who's 37 years old in Austin, Texas, he sued his date. He took her to the movies and sued her because she did what the whole time during the movie? Any guesses? He was upset. He feels like she didn't enjoy the experience because she was doing something the entire time during the movie.
I'll go with played Candy Crush.
Well, you're really close. She was texting on her phone during the two movies. He was so offended. They had gone to see Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2, which I think was a big one for people that like that stuff. He claimed her behavior was breaking theater rules and was affecting his movie watching experience. So she agreed to pay him $17.31 for the cinema ticket if he left her alone. And he then withdrew the lawsuit. Don't think that one had a good chance anyways, Kevin.
You can always find a willing lawsuit and a willing lawyer, right?
Well, that's what I'm finding with some of these cases. There's crazy ones that are even overseas. I'll have to share some of those where people actually won that I couldn't believe it. But we'll get to some more of those later on. Kevin, always good to see you, my friend.
Nice to be back.
From Camden Law, we're talking about wills and trusts and everyone preparing for all of that important stuff. Forbes published a study recently. I don't know whether this surprises me or not, probably not you, that about half of the people over the age of 55 have not yet created a will. Number one, does that surprise you? And number two, boy, that's a problem.
It doesn't surprise me. It would probably be more accurate if it said people over the age of 55 have not either put a will or an estate plan together or revised it recently. Mm-hmm. And I think that number would probably, in my experience, be closer to 80%. And what was the second question?
Oh, wait. Sorry. 80% of people have not made one or revised one recently.
We have folks that come in on a routine basis. We love to see them, and they'll tell us. It's been, you know, 20, 25 years since we started having kids. And while we love them, we're not so concerned that they get everything now. We want it to go to the grandkids, so we need to update things. Knowing what we know about, you know, human nature and society now, in 25 years, some people have a second or a third or maybe even more marriages. Yeah. So we need to address those concerns. It's the update that's as much of a concern for us as it is having it in place altogether.
Yeah, because life changes and those things that are in place, I mean, I mean, they're legally binding. If you made them 25 years ago, it still sticks, yeah? There can't be too many arguments after the fact of, well, life has changed.
They are, and it's comical to a degree, but I had a conversation with a fellow the other day, and he kind of scratched his head and said, well, you know, my kids are in their late 20s now, and I'm not sure they want to go live with my sister Susie if my wife and I pass away. Now, of course, that wouldn't happen
because
they were
right.
of majority, but the point
but still.
Is... there's updating that needs to be done, and without getting too deep into the weeds, there are tax concerns you have to be cognizant of as well, because if the estate tax changes, you may need to do some other things. We're in a good position presently with state and federal, although we've heard some discussion about maybe federal estate tax changing. Haven't seen any legislation proposed yet to that effect.
Wait, let me just pause for a second. When you say if the laws change, that's a good time to revisit things too, because you want to maximize whatever you can or make sure that you're in compliance with whatever has changed.
Absolutely. So presently in the state of Illinois, the estate tax is $4 million or higher. So if you pass away and have a net worth greater than that, you may get hit with a significant estate tax. And, I'd rather give money to family, friends, fraternal organizations
yes.
than give it to the government when I pass away.
Yeah.
So that's a concern there as well.
Boy, I just want to reiterate to that to people, because I think that some people may even think that they're covered. Maybe they've every life changed, they do something, but I didn't even think about legislation changing. And even if you don't know, right, like that's got to be something you don't want to Google, go down that rabbit hole. Talk to you guys. You guys are going to know the details, right?
We do. We try and stay on top of everything that's happening with both the estate tax number and then novel ways to minimize estate taxes. There are ways you can do it that are inexpensive that make sure the government gets less and less and your heirs and the folks that you're concerned about get
right.
the bulk of your estate.
And there's no shame in doing it, because you're doing it through the legal channels that are provided by the government. I know some people like kind of go, well, that seems shady, but hey, it's not. I mean, you are following the laws that are written, and it can benefit a lot of organizations you mentioned. There's ways to make sure that it's spread out the right way.
Financial planner that I work with very closely with Guardian Assist often says grieving is tough, and we understand that, of course, but our focus is for the people that are left behind. What are we doing for the spouses, for the kids, for the grandkids? It makes things very fundamental things like, what do you wish for a funeral service? We can get that specific in estate planning documents to, of course, what's going to happen with homes and bank accounts and these sorts of things. It makes it a lot easier for who's left rather than just kind of guessing.
Yeah. In the study published by Forbes as well, they said only 18% of people in the age range that we mentioned, over 55, have all of the recommended legacy plan essentials. A will, they say, a healthcare directive, and durable power of attorney. I know what a will is. What are the other two things that they're mentioning there in that Forbes study? What's a healthcare directive?
Healthcare directive, it kind of goes hand in glove with a power of attorney for health care. It allows somebody to act as your surrogate to make decisions on your behalf. Presumably, you've had discussions with those people, and they know exactly what end-of-life measures you choose or would not choose, so that you don't wind up in a circumstance where you're being left on life support when you didn't choose
right.
that choice. And the reality is, and we've talked about this since COVID kind of sunk in last year,
mm-hmm.
it's COVID now that's a concern. Hopefully, in 6 months,
a year
or 2 years, we'll be on to something else.
Please.
But we hear a lot of folks that are very concerned about, COVID. Well, 2 years from now, we may be back to, heart disease or cancer or whatever the case is. So, we joke, and it's morbid humor, but it's true. Nobody gets out of it alive. So rather than leave a mess, frankly, for your children, let's do some planning so that everything is in a row, all the ducks in a row, to use a cliche. And the reality is, my folks who I know, God love them, are listening, are at the tip of that baby boom age. Both of them will be 75 this summer. They're starting to pass away mm-hmm. at a lot higher percentage. So we want to make sure things are put together. It's very, very difficult for me personally when we have clients that come in, and typically they're adult children, who will say, Mom and Dad had a ton of money. Dad passed away years ago. Mom doesn't suffer for money, but we never did any of these things. Powers of attorney, let's assume the parent is still alive. And we have to put Mom in a state home when we
right.
know we could afford a private home. but we can't really get access to the money. Now, we can fix that. We'll go through a procedure, but it'll take, you know, a few bucks and time. And the reality is nobody wants to see anybody linger in a home that they would rather choose not to be in, and maybe provide for a higher level of care, but it just takes time to get that done. Whereas if we sit and talk now, put everything in place, if mom, and again, I mean to be respectful, but if mom wakes up tomorrow and can't remember what day it is,
right,
we've checked the boxes and we're ready to go. And we know that if or when this happens, somebody will be able to take over for them.
Your scenario you just hit on, I want to just pause for a moment on, because you're talking about a situation where maybe one of the parents has passed away, unfortunately. Money is fine, but you're saying that there's not access to the money to provide for the other parent should they need a nicer nursing home. Like, the money is there. So I think a lot of people might be in that boat where they think, well, if one parent passes away, it's okay. It all transfers to the other and we're going to be just A-okay. You're saying that's not always the case.
That's absolutely the case. If mom is of mental competence and she can make her decisions, God bless, and everything's awesome. Right. The problem is when that person can't.
Oh my gosh.
Right? And then we have to sort of scramble and figure out how to fix things. And if we spend, you know, a couple hours on the front end and a few bucks to put everything in place, mom has peace of mind. She doesn't have to worry. Kids have peace of mind because they know that if the event happens, both A, what mom's directions are, B, how we're going to pay for it, and then who's going to make the decisions.
All right. We're going to do another segment. I want you to, just in case someone's running out of the car or something, how can people reach out to you? Because that, I think, is going to ping for a lot of people.
Sure. The office phone is simple, 630-568-6656. And the office webpage, which has a dedicated intake, is Camden, C-A-M-D-E-N, lawoffice.com.
And in radio, we're told to do the number twice, 630-568-6656.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
All right. Very good. Okay. We're going to take a quick commercial break, and we'll have plenty more here on Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association. All right. Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association. Picking up our conversation with Kevin Camden and Camden Law, 630-568-6656. You know, sometimes, Kevin, there are uncomfortable conversations to have, but they're important ones to have, and it gives you so much peace of mind, like the scenario you were just laying out beforehand, too. Let's get to a question. We got a caller from Jim. Jim, you got a question here for Kevin. Go ahead, Jim.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm actually doing my spring cleaning, the thing you do every 5 years, and I did a will in 2016. I did a trust in 2019. Do I need to do something to cancel the will?
A will in 2016, a trust in 2019.
Not necessarily, correct, Jim. You know, I'll give you the standard lawyer caveat. Without looking at the documents, it's hard for me to say. My biggest concern is that there's a conflict between the trust and the will, which creates a problem once you pass away. My preference, and typically the way we do them in the office, is recommend a pour-over will with a trust, and essentially that says everything you own, according to the will, gets dumped into your trust, and then your trustee disposes of everything. If it's still set up that way, even though the trust was a couple of years later, or if the trust mirrors whatever the inheritance provisions are in the will, I'm okay with it. If they don't and there's some conflict, I would recommend you tighten it up and look at amending the will so that it's consistent with the trust.
Okay. How do you amend a will with a lawyer who created it that's no longer alive?
That's easy. You can come see any lawyer, bring the original docs or at least copies with us. And typically, when you add what's big dollar legal terms here, codicils or amendments to a will, we will indicate that the prior will with respect to these provisions is no longer valid, and we wish to substitute these paragraphs or these provisions.
Okay, and you guys can do that?
We do.
Look at that.
I'll be calling you next week.
All right.
Very well. Thank you.
630-568-6656. Thanks, Jim. We appreciate the phone call. Yeah, and I imagine that's fairly common for people, right? That happens.
We do. We often, you know, again, it's the human condition. We don't all live forever, right? And folks pass away, and the fortunate lawyers get to retire, and folks don't know where to go. So we often pick up old documents and update them. Not an issue.
773 texted in with Camden Law Offices. How much is a basic package for creating an estate plan? The will, the power, the attorney, et cetera. I know that's a very broad question. Can you help out folks a little bit and understand that?
We can. Our preference in the office is to do a revocable trust and a pour-over will.
What does that mean?
Will.
Sorry.
No, it's okay. For purposes of estate planning, you can have a revocable trust, which means you can change it as you see fit. Or if we want to get into more sophisticated Medicare or asset protection trusts, we get into irrevocable trusts. And there are benefits and burdens to both. For most folks, if they're not at a time where they're worried about moving into extended care, or if they have concerns about Medicare recapture, revocable trusts are going to do exactly what you want. Our package includes the trust, powers of attorney for the husband and wife. We will convey one property into the trust, which I think is hugely significant, and we'll loop back to that. Abstract of trust, anything that anybody would need relative to your estate plan, we put together, and our fee for that is $2,500.
Okay. And that could save you a lot of hassle and money in the long run. Let's zoom out even further. And just in case someone is a little lost, trust, will, basic definitions of kind of both.
So the benefit of a trust, regardless of what kind, is when you pass away, you get to avoid probate court, you get to avoid any public filing of a will, and it allows for your successor trustee to act in the capacity of the trustee and do whatever. So the classic example would be dad passes away and there's a trust, mom becomes the successor trustee, everything dad owns passes to mom. Mom passes away and the oldest child now becomes a successor trustee. That successor trustee gets to wrap up all the affairs of the estate, including, and I know this will be a bit of a spoiler alert, I see it all the time, mom and dad, kids don't want the house they grow up in.
Mm-hmm.
They want the money from the house that they grew up in, but they don't necessarily want the house.
Well, they moved away. I mean, there's many reasons.
And it's awesome because with a trust, we avoid the statutory 6-month period of probate. It allows folks to move more quickly, dispose of assets, clean up bank accounts, do all of these sorts of things that happen by operation of the instrument instead of waiting for approval in the court and to go through the probate process.
Do people feel, I mean, it's inherent in the name trust. Is there sometimes concern that, hey, I want to write this all out and spell out every little thing and I don't trust anyone to take this over for me?
The example we use, John, is the trust is, to a degree, you could look at it like a present, but we use the example of a box. And when the trust maker passes away, you open up the box, and the very first thing in the top of the box is a sheet of instructions, which is the trust. And it says, A, B, C, D, here's what to do with all of my stuff, which makes it very, very easy for the trustee. I don't like mistakes or surprises. We certainly don't like mistakes, but we don't like surprises for folks that are acting as trustees, power of attorney, and we counsel our clients all the time. You need to talk to these folks because you don't want to pass away and then have somebody say, yeah, I'm not comfortable doing that. Now, we build in protections, but typically that first successor trustee is somebody, oftentimes a spouse, the surviving spouse, or children, and you want them to be comfortable with what they're doing.
So even if I'm really sorry for these basic questions, but I'm sure someone else has them. At least I hope they do. So if someone is concerned that a trust is going to just give someone else the power to do everything, you can still outline what you want to have happen to certain things, and the trustee will be obligated to do a lot of that.
Correct. And the trustee has obligations. They have to act as a fiduciary of the trust, which essentially means they have to do A, what the trust provides for, and B, act consistent with the trust. They can't just go rogue and decide that, you know, all of the funds that were in the trust are now going to be theirs and they're going to go buy a new boat and be out on the lake on a great day like today.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. That's also good to know. When we were talking about difficult conversations, do you recommend someone have all these difficult conversations with people before they even come to you? Or can you help someone determine what those conversations need to be with other people? At what stage should people call you and come to you?
We can go either way with it. We have clients that come in and say, you know, we've already looked at all of this. We know who we want to be powers of attorney. We want to know who successor trustees are. If we have children, we know who wants to be guardian and all of these sorts of things. Typically, if somebody calls and says, I'd like to put an estate plan together, we have about a 15-page questionnaire that we send out. We ask folks to start filling it out for us, return it to us, and then we'll set up a consultation where we can walk through everything, make sure, A, folks understand, and B, that we've got everything put together. I'm also a huge fan of this for, last time we were together, we talked about real estate. A lot of my investor clients have properties that we funnel into trusts for purposes of maintaining them for the benefit of the family. So we can talk about the nuances of, well, who gets properties, or if we own stock, or if I own my own LLC, who gets these sort of things. Mm-hmm. So we can bring those small businesses in, and a lot of small business owners often neglect this, not intentionally. Of course, they're just not aware of it. Business is great. You own it yourself, or you may own it with your spouse, and you have no succession plans. And sadly, estate planning and probate looks an awful lot like divorce when there's a lot of money left after mom and dad pass away, if it's not squared away the right way.
Right. I'm glad that you guys have that like questionnaire. I think a lot of people are frozen because they don't know where to begin, and it's nice to know that you can help take those first steps. Kevin, we're out of time. 630-568-6656. What's the website people can go to as well?
CamdenLawOffice.com. CamdenLawOfficeSingular.com.
We'll talk again soon, my friend, okay?
Thanks, John. Good to see you.
I teed up a California lawsuit against Starbucks. One gentleman by the name of Alexander Forozesh says that Starbucks has too much what in their drinks, and we're going to Chris in Naperville. Chris, what's your guess?
Hi, John. Sugar.
No, it's not sugar, although one could certainly make that case. And maybe that's why I keep on visiting there every now and again. Are you do you like sugary coffee drinks, Chris, or no?
No, I do not. No. I always have them put half of the sweetener in any of their lattes.
Mm, smart, smart there. Here, I'm going to help you out a little bit, Chris. I know we've had lawsuits in the past, including we have another one in Texas right now about hot coffee. Let's say it has something to do with the opposite of a coffee being too hot. Starbucks puts what too much in their drinks? A second guess here for you.
Cream?
No.
Or milk?
No. One more. What do you want to do to make coffee cold if you want it cold?
Ice.
Ice, yes. A California resident who orders only cold drinks from Starbucks said that they receive less liquid in their cups than advertised because of too much ice. But a district judge put that case on ice. He ruled that even a child can tell that an ice in a cup reduces the amount of liquid you get. And since it's a clear cup they give you, you could just say, hey, I don't want that much ice. And they threw the lawsuit out. Chris, you got it by the third or fourth guess. That works.
Thank you, John.
Have a great...
I listen to you all the time. My nephew is Kevin Camden.
Oh, wow.
He was just on a little while ago.
There we go. I love keeping it in the family. He did great, and Chris, you did too. Thanks for the phone call.
Oh, you're welcome.
Appreciate that. Chris out in Naperville related to Kevin Camden. And one more time, that number for Kevin Camden, 630-568-6656. All right, let's shift gears here and talk about something that's very important to a lot of folks out there, and it's important to have someone on your side when you need it, and that someone is Joseph Bombaghetti. He's the attorney associate at Kelly Law Firm and at Law Tigers. Joseph, thanks for joining us here on this Saturday afternoon.
Thanks, John. Thanks for your listeners for giving us the opportunity to come on and talk.
Yeah, and we're talking a lot about motorcycle accidents and hiring an attorney after that, making sure that you're well representative. And, you know, this is a question I often ask lawyers when they come on. You know, why you? What separates you from the rest of the pack? Why should they reach you? And when I go to the website and your biography, Joseph, not only are you well-respected, you've won awards, but there you are in your photo on a motorcycle. And I think that's important, right? That someone has someone that knows what they're talking about, knows what the person who's going through something has dealt with. Do you feel that way too?
Oh, absolutely. You know, if you haven't had the experience, it's awfully difficult to relate to someone who has. So, you know, knowing how the bike operates, knowing what a rider experiences, in a crash or leading up to a crash, if you haven't lived it, it's awfully hard to be able to relate to it.
Yeah, not only relate, but just the language around it, right? I think that you can cut through a lot of the, I don't want to say the red tape, but you can cut through a lot of it. Not, you know, you're already up, pardon the pun, you're already up to speed on these sorts of things.
Oh, absolutely, yeah, without a doubt.
All right, so lawtigers.com, which, by the way, is a great website. It's easy to use. I immediately was pinged asking if I had any questions by an associate right there on the website. I can pick a state, pick a region, and it really helps out. Tell us a little bit about lawtigers.com and what you guys do there.
Sure. Law Tigers was founded in 2001, and we are a network of nationwide local law firms. So it's, you know, unlike some of these other organizations where, you know, if you call in and you get, a representative that's, you know, five states away, if you call in with Law Tigers, you're going to get a lawyer that is, you know, probably within an hour at most from where you're located.
And do you guys handle, I mean, it's mostly motorcycle accidents, or is it other things as well?
So our law firm handles more than just motorcycle cases, auto cases, slip and falls. But Law Tigers, we primarily focus on the motorcycle related. And when I say motorcycle, basically anything that's a motor you ride. So scooters, trikes, you know, the Can-Ams, Harleys, Metrics, you name it. If it's got a motor and you ride on it, you know, call us if you have an issue.
It seems like a very specific thing, but I imagine that having a team that is dedicated to that, first of all, it's a one-stop shop for people. They know where to go. They know to go to lawtigers.com if there's anything motorcycle related. But I imagine there's nuances like in any law, and having a team that is dedicated to that specifically, you're going to get a lot more out of that experience.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, although as the plaintiff, you hope people sympathize with what you're going through. You know, when you bring a claim, you're immediately looked at as being suspect. You know, you're out for money, something like that. So it's very important to know what kind of biases as a motorcycle rider you're facing, you know, in addition just the normal person who's bringing a claim. You know, you referenced the McDonald's lawsuit. You know, that's the first thing that comes up in any time we go to trial and there's voir dire. Does anybody remember that case? What do you think about it?
You mentioned biases as a motorcycle rider. Do you think there are biases against motorcycle riders in general, just because if you aren't one, maybe you have a negative connotation on what that means, or you've had experiences on the roadways that influence what you think about it? What do you mean by biases for motorcycle riders?
Oh, absolutely. You know, say what you want about, you know, Sons of Anarchy or those other kinds of shows. But, you know, a lot of times people put, you know, the guy or the gal in the leathers on the Harley, you know, with some tattoos and long hair. They think they're, you know, right off the bad person. Mm. Or, you know, driving on the expressway, I'm sure every one of us, unfortunately, has seen, the motorcyclist that's popping a wheelie or doing something. Those are things that stick in people's minds, and it's awfully difficult, you know, to have people put those aside to realize, you know, this situation is not that.
And I'm so glad you brought that up, because we have had conversations on this radio station, specifically in the last couple of weeks, of people saying, oh, I've seen a lot of motorcyclists at one time, and it scared me on the roadways, or X, Y, or Z happened, they were popping wheelies. And yes, of course, that's an important issue, and of course, we have to talk about it. But just because someone else is injured in a motorcycle accident, that rider, that is wrong to associate with them that what you saw on the roadways happened to you.
Absolutely. And that's, you know, that's when you go to a trial, that's the things you have to sort through, is who has those biases, who's had that experience in life that's a negative impact on, you know, your ability to recover for your client.
For sure. Why should someone go to lawtigers.com immediately? Or I guess I should ask, should someone go immediately? Or should you try and haggle with insurance? Like, at what point of the process is it best to reach out to lawtigers.com and to you?
So I would invite anyone to go to lawtigers.com now, because we have great resources for riders to get to kind of arm themselves before you even hit the road.
For example, so before an accident, anything, like get educated right now.
Oh, absolutely. So we have lots of articles for laws around the country, because, like I said, we're a collection or a network of nationwide local law firms. So, you know, if you have questions about helmet laws or things like that in your particular state, it's a great resource. And hopefully we can talk about this in a little while, John, would be insurance considerations and recommendations. Just in general, a great resource to add to your collection of places to go to look for information. You know, the more you know, the better it is.
Yeah, let's go right to that, because when you talk about insurance, we talked to auto insurance a couple weeks ago, and boy, I think a lot of people just choose whatever's cheapest. They don't even know the labels or what it is or what kind of coverage they have. I imagine for motorcycle riders too, choosing that correct insurance is a really important step and can help them if anything happens.
Absolutely, and it's actually even more complex than with your car.
Really?
And the reason for that is lots of riders will have custom parts put on their motorcycles. And your normal coverage for your motorcycle won't cover more than, say, 1,000 or two. So if you've got a Harley Davidson that you've put a ton of chrome on, you've got, you know, $10,000 worth of this and that and the extra, if you don't have the extra accessory or custom parts coverage and something happens, you don't have coverage for that extra. That doesn't increase the value of your vehicle.
Wow. When we talked about auto insurance, we talked about liability or like a certain dollar amount. Is there like a recommendation you have just off the bat for someone that's listening right now, or is it not as simple as a dollar amount for coverage?
Oh, no. So let's clarify some terms, John.
Yes,
so liability. Yeah, no. Liability is the coverage that applies if you do something to someone else. Mm-hmm. Liability does not provide any benefits to you if something happens to you in a crash. Those types of coverage are medical payments coverage. So that's if you get hurt, payment for your medical bills. It's especially important if you don't have health insurance. And then the two most critical are underinsured and uninsured motorist coverage. So the underinsured applies if the other person doesn't have enough coverage, and uninsured applies if the other person does not have any coverage. And based upon some recent insurance company statistics, roughly 30% of drivers don't have insurance. So that is a huge coverage to have. And as far as amounts go, we recommend that you get as much coverage as you can afford.
Mm-hmm.
Typically, that's $250,000 or $300,000. Plus a personal umbrella. And the umbrella coverage is pennies on the dollars compared to the amount of coverage that you get. So, and you can get those that information on our website. It's called a biker benefit card. It's a little like wallet that you can put in your saddlebag or keep on your person that's got all of those recommendations printed on the back of it. So you can take it right to your insurance agent and say, hey, get me this. Or give me a quote on this.
Yeah. Joseph Bomaghetti from Kelly Law Firm. Again, local law firm, but part of the network of Law Tigers at lawtigers.com. We're going to take a quick commercial break. Joseph, we'll have more after this here on Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association. I don't drive motorcycles. I'm kind of jealous, though, because there is no site like this for any automobile drivers. I'm talking about lawtigers.com or anything else. It is so simple. It is informative. Someone, as you go to the website, immediately asks you if you have need to chat with anyone. You scroll down, there's videos, and then you just click on a giant map. You click on Illinois if you want to find an attorney to help you out. Gives you a couple locations. You hit Chicago and you're immediately connected with three different lawyers, including Joseph Bombaghetti, who's a local guy, a partner attorney at Kelly Law. And Joseph, it's so sleek, it's so easy to use, and I imagine that is such an advantage for you and for people that are riders, because if it, you know, unfortunately, if something happens, that's usually someone's worst day. It's nice to know with lawtigers.com. It's like simple to use, and it gets to you immediately, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And let's talk about that. If someone is in an accident, obviously, again, an unfortunate situation, what are the immediate steps someone needs to do themselves or family members?
Sure. First and foremost is you want to call the police. You need them to come out there and make a report to document what happened.
Even like for something minor, I know people sometimes are skeptical of that, but like you never know what could be hidden, right? Like,
well, I would say at the very least, you're going to want to get the insurance information from the other person. You know, if we're talking about a fender bender where there's not much there, especially on the expressway, you know, a lot of times the police you call in, they'll tell you just exchange information and move on.
Cool.
But if it's if you think there's something wrong, I definitely reach out to the police so they can come out and make a report. You're going to want to take photographs of the scene and of the vehicles involved, you know, because that's a big thing. Is a lot of times people come to us and the evidence at the scene is gone. There's no way for us to recreate, you know, what happens a week or two or 3 months beforehand. I already talked about getting you insurance information. Next would be make sure that you get medical attention if you think you need it. You know, even if you're just a little sore, it's better safe than sorry. And obviously the last thing would be make sure you call Law Tigers.
Yeah. And so how does that work? I mean, I do like to know, I mean, what should someone be armed with? What questions should we be asking you if we're in that situation? I think sometimes we always wonder what they're going to ask us. What should a motorcycle rider ask you?
Sure. For one, you kind of want to know, does the lawyer that you're talking with, do they have experience with motorcycle cases? We talked about how important it is to have somebody who knows, you know, what they're dealing with. A couple other things would be property damage. A lot of lawyers, a lot of personal injury lawyers, don't handle property damage. We do that for free. That is something that we do as part of your injury case. So there's no fee whatsoever for us to make sure your bike gets fixed, totaled, whatever that case might be. Another question that you'd want to ask is how do I pay you and how much do you get paid?
Right.
So most injury attorneys work on what's called a contingent fee. Law Tigers, we do the same way. It's you don't get, you know, there's no fee unless you win. You don't pay us unless you win. One thing that sets us apart from the majority is our fee will never be more than what the person gets with a check at the end of their case.
We After will everything.
Always reduce. We will always reduce our fee to make sure we never get paid more than the injured person.
Yeah, and because that is sometimes not the case, right? Because
Correct.
Once you have
Absolutely.
To pay a bunch of other people, you may not be getting anything, and then you're still owing a lawyer on top of it.
Absolutely, because there's things called liens, medical bills. We negotiate all of those to make sure that we maximize our client's money at the end of the day.
I got to say, it's a great resource. I said it at the beginning. I'm like, I'm a little jealous I'm not a motorcycle rider. I wish I had assets like this because
it's not too late to start, John.
Yeah, you're absolutely right about that. It's a sleek website. It's easy to use. And also 1-800-LAW-TIGERS is a great place to start as well. They can help you out. Joseph, I really appreciate you stopping by, okay?
Thank you so much for the time, John. Thank you for the opportunity.
Hey, how hot is it on a day like today to ride around? I can't imagine. Is it comfortable out there, or does the wind make it feel great no matter what, no matter how hot it is out there?
While you're moving, it's tolerable. Once you stop, it's as hot as anything. Well, actually more because you're sitting right on top of your engine.
That's okay. Well, maybe I'll choose a day that's in the 70s. Does that work for you, Joseph?
Sounds good.
All right. Thanks, Joseph. Bob McGetty, and you go to lawtakers.com for more information. Okay. After the break, I think you've all heard about the Nirvana cover, and I teased this a little bit with John Williams yesterday. Kessler, I know you and I were talking about that, about the gentleman who was an infant at the time, naked on the Nirvana cover. Well, 30 years later, he is suing not for any like infringement on copyright or anything like that. He is suing because he claims that Nirvana, it's essentially a child pornography case. You remember the infant is naked in the picture. Well, we have a lawyer to break down whether it is or it isn't. And there is something shocking you need to know if you own this album cover. And we'll get to that after the news here on WGN and Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association. I'm sure by now you've heard the story of everyone remembers the famous Nirvana cover from 1991, Nevermind, the naked baby swimming after the $20 bill. Well, there's some drama now, some 30 years later after the album has been released. And joining us to talk about that, professor at the University of Illinois College of Law, Paul Heald. Paul, thanks for joining us here today.
It's great to be here.
So, you know, I can only chuckle, but it is an interesting story because Spencer Eldon, who is the infant in the picture, is now suing, claiming that the iconic artwork is child pornography. He's suing the band over alleged child sexual exploitation. You handle a lot of intellectual property and other things around that. What do you make of this case?
Right. Well, people have been asking me questions because I'm a copyright guy and it involves a photo. And, you know, it turns out that the subjects of photos don't have any interest, copyright interest in the photos themselves. So there's really no copyright issues. I'm an expert because I was once, in fact, a naked baby. That's where I get my insight from that.
And I guess we're all experts then in a way.
And that, and look, I actually have looked at the complaint and looked at the law. So I'm not completely talking off the cuff here. But I think it's interesting to people because instinctively we know this is crazy, right? This can't possibly be a winning lawsuit. But on the other hand, we don't instantly sort of know why this shouldn't work. I took a look at the complaint and the law, and it you know, if in fact this was child pornography, he in fact could, you know, successfully sue not only the people who took the picture, but the people who distributed the picture. But if you look at the definition on the Department of Justice website, it has to be a visual depiction of sexually explicit conduct, which most of us probably don't see when we look at that picture. And if you look at sort of the cases, there's sort of a six-part test setting forth whether something's sexually explicit or not. And the case just seems to flunk about every single part of the test. The first part is the focal point of the picture, the child's genitalia or pubic area. Well, I mean, think about it. The focal point is the kid grabbing. It's his fingers grabbing for the money, right? That's what the picture is all about.
Mm-hmm.
Is the setting sexually suggestive? I don't think most people would think so. Is the child in inappropriate attire considering its age? Does the child's conduct suggest sexual coyness or willingness to engage in sexual activity? Boy, I don't want to meet the person.
Right, right. <for that.
laughs> And finally, whether the conduct is intended to designed to elicit a sexual response from the viewer. I think most people, now that they know the test and take a look at the picture and figure out that now this case isn't going anywhere.
It is interesting, though, and I appreciate you kind of laying out the actual language of the test, because when we normally talk about pornography or something obscene, we immediately go to Justice Potter's definition, which is sort of that you know it when you see it, which I guess also applies here.
Yeah, I think so. Certainly our intuitions come from that sort of gut sense. But if you look at this test, it sort of does, embody or it provides more detail and a little bit more richness to how we articulate our intuition that this is, in fact, not pornography. My favorite part of this case is, though, if this guy wins, right? So his mm-hmm. is that this image, that this photo is, in fact, child pornography. If he's right, then every single person who owns this album is guilty of possessing child pornography, and the minimum sentence is 5 years in prison. And this is strict liability. You don't get to argue that you didn't know or that you don't think it's pornography. If, in fact, it's held to be criminally pornographic, you are a criminal merely for owning the album.
Even if you bought it at a time when it wasn't ruled to be that?
Correct. Absolutely. 5-year minimum sentence. So, again, that
wow.
That maybe this lawsuit isn't going anywhere.
Yeah, I would say so. Hey, I did want to ask, he's not suing about the copyright sort of thing, but, allegedly this involved his parents getting $200. There was nothing written down about the deal, he claims. He said in the past, he says he's seen none of that money. This is an interesting area where you could, parents do obviously, you don't expect an infant to be signing these deals, of course, but this does bring up really interesting intellectual property, aspects in terms of, as a kid, you really don't have too much right to your own image.
No, it's true. And it's really more of a family law question than anything else. But, typically parents are, have pretty much total control over their children. And I don't think a child has a privacy right that a parent can actually somehow abuse. I mean, a parent, of course, is horribly guilty if, in fact, this was child pornography.
Of course.
But as far as a separate freestanding privacy right, if a parent tells a story about, when you peed yourself in kindergarten and it's horribly embarrassing and it's makes all your friends laugh at you, they shouldn't do that if their parents... But they haven't violated any sort of enforceable right that you have to privacy in terms of your own story or even the way you look. So I don't think there's really even much of a privacy angle to this going on, although he claims to be horribly embarrassed by this now. By the way, he's participated in all sorts of reshoots of this photograph over the years. And has, in the prior 30 years, has never indicated that he suffered the tremendous emotional distress that he currently claims to be suffering.
Certainly. Yeah, it did make me suspect, because as soon as I Googled this guy, I saw what you said. I think it was at the 25-year anniversary, him in a pool. He's wearing a swimsuit, but he's replicating the exact photo. And I'm like, well, 5 years ago, you didn't seem to be all too upset by it. I won't guess then what his motivations are. We'll leave that for another day. Professor, before I let you go, I want, you know, you're in Helsinki. You are a professor at the College of University of Illinois. What you doing there?
I've got a. I'm on a Fulbright at the Hankin School of Economics here. I'm teaching a economics and intellectual property law course, and I'm doing some research on Finnish book and music markets. And in an hour, I'll be heading out to a happy hour at a Finnish brewery.
All the power to you. Well earned after a hard week of work. And thank you so much for joining us, Professor.
All right. Thanks for having me. Give me a call anytime.
All right. Absolutely. Yeah. And you can tell that I interviewed him a little bit ago, because Helsinki is 8 hours ahead of where we are. Iridian, I'm trying to do the math here. I should know that. What would that be? About 12:45 in the morning tomorrow.
Wow.
Yeah, no, that was not the case. I really appreciate the professor. I got up at 5 a.m. to do that interview, which is why I probably stumbled and bumbled my way through those questions. But are you a fan of Nirvana? I mean, that's a little before your time, right? Yes.
Yes, but I still am a fan. Mm-hmm.
But you don't have to throw away the album, because I don't think this case is going anywhere. But I found that interesting, that if you bought the album in 1991, you've got it in your closet. Let's say this guy wins his case about child pornography, that you automatically can go to jail for 5 years just for having that.
How would you even track people down who have the album?
I don't know. I don't think you would. I think that, first of all, I don't think the case is going anywhere, like the professor said. But yeah, I don't think you'd be able to do that.
Yeah.
Maybe just hide it away just in case for a couple months till we figure out what happened. But also, like, the album covers, like, if you play Spotify or Pandora, right? Mm-hmm. Like, it's on your phone. They show your album cover. It's an interesting case. Probably not going anywhere. But it fits in with the theme today of a bunch of crazy lawsuits that mostly did not go anywhere. We'll be back next Saturday at 3 o'clock. And we've got 3 hours of fun as we lead into college football action. That's next Saturday. As for me, John Hanson, you can follow me on Twitter or on Instagram if you choose. JonHanson. I know, two names you could spell wrong. That's okay. That's how you follow me. And I'll be in for John Williams on Monday at 9 a.m. We'll be talking about the first day of school for CPS students. I want to hear all about your embarrassing first day of school adventures. I know we all have a story somewhere about that. I'd love to hear from you as well. And we'll be covering everything that's happening with Hurricane Ida and, of course, what's happening in Afghanistan as well. Thank you so much for joining us here on Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association. That'll do it for